Blog Talk Radio.
Let's go. Yeah. Ghetto children singing. See, what up? They eager to learn how to become the next world leaders. Brave hearts. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but masterfully notice the weakness in all them. Gotta you show me if necessary. Homie, investors is very real. If enemies carrying heavy steel, beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind of beauty of life. But when my mom said, again, you could be Christ, I wasn't old enough to hold my D&P right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him, little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training in difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina banging. Splitting duchess up, strap up. The army's a school, teaching smart ways to go. I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool. Got me thinking out loud. Sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals I build. With dudes and Chris worth a quarter mil and Dick Hill. For fish scales and cops, the time come I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the peas. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa. 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holster. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Of the system, I'm like a modern day Hitler. Black gorilla, crib and blood in one only. Bullet. Know my face, I be the case for the wish at the police. Look at the name Lake. Go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute the new.
Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab a robber. The woman plays an important part of our life force. So what we fight for, my heart goes to you beautiful wife in war.
And listen more and talk less. Watch all and trust none. Demand your respect and be ready to die for what you believe in. And ride all the time, not just when convenient.
Justice is freedom, wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule is strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's spared.
Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer, right?
Yes.
And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson, sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see you today.
family heirs.
Starring Gary Dordan from TVCSI.
This is the military, David.
Free or lying. Revolutionary greeting. Welcome to another edition of Georgia University Radio. I'm your host, Buman Shakir, where I go as a fivefold. Our first goal is to eradicate false illiteracy among new African prisoners. Our second goal is to eradicate cultural ignorance among new African prisoners. Our third goal is to transfer the criminal mentality to the new African mentality. Our fourth goal is to assist in the rebuilding and stabilization of new African communities. Our fifth goal is to prepare a new African prisoner for release, reducing new African recidivism. And our overall goal is to transform the whole prison to a slave complex to the prison system that big interest to learn through educational means, by in turn transforming the criminal mentality to a revolutionary mentality. Before I bring in our guest tonight, I'll go over a couple of events that happened in history. On October the 17th, 1787, Boston Blacks, led by Prince Hall, who was a Mason, petitioned legislation for equal school facilities. To 1817, Samuel Ringgold Ward, minister, abolitionist, author, was born on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. 1871, President Grant suspended the writ of habeas corpus and declared martial law in 9 South Carolina counties affected by Klan disturbances. 1888, the Capital Savings Bank of Washington, D.C., the first black bank, opened in Washington, D.C. The savings banks of the Order of True Reformers, Richmond, Virginia, were chartered on March 2, 1888. October 18, Baba Jalil Abdul Mukti King was born in 1951. Baba Jalil Mukti King was a former New African political prisoner, did like 49 years in prison. He was a former member of the Black Panther Party of Self-Defense, a former member of the Black Liberation Army. He was the founding members of the New African Liberation Front, a founding Jericho Amnesty International, an author, and an overall freedom fighter for our people. October 18, 1969, L.A. Black Panther member Walter Touré Pope was murdered by the cops. 1989, U.S. Census Bureau said the poverty rate for blacks in 1988 was 31.6% compared to 10.1% for whites and 26.8% for Hispanics. October 19, 1865, Major General O.O. Howe, head of the Freedmen Bureau, told a Freedmen mass meeting in Edesto, South Carolina, that the government had decided to return confiscated land to the planters. In South Carolina, Virginia, and other southern states, freedmen organized military relief and resisted attempts to respond to the land. In 1870, the first blacks elected to the House of Representatives. Black Republican won 3 of the 4 congressional seats in South Carolina. Joseph H. Rainey, Robert C. DeLarge, and Robert B. Elliott. Rainey was elected to the expired term in the 45th Congress and was the first black seated in the House. Also, in 1870, Republicans swept South Carolina election with a ticket of 6 whites and 2 blacks, Alonzo Rayner, Lieutenant Governor, Francis L. Cardoza, Secretary of State. Okay. I missed one. 1891, we were in the birth of Jomo Kenyatta, leader of the Mau Mau Liberation Force and president of Kenya and Africa. 1942, 60 leading Southern black issued Durham Manifesto, called a fundamental change in race relations at the Durham, North Carolina meeting. 1981, hold on, I moved too fast. I'm sorry, I apologize, I moved too fast. Let me go back. In 1943, Theater Gear presentation of Othello opened at New York's Sherbert Theater with Paul Robeson in title role. Production ran for 296 performances and set a record for Shakespearean drama on Broadway. In 1948, United Nations mediator Ralph Bonshi reported that the Israelis and the Egyptians were guilty of a truce violation. The United Nations Security Council ordered immediate ceasefire in southern Palestine. Also, in the 19th, Edward Delta Nant, ambassador to Liberia. Also, the Springer Medal claimed Channing H. Tobias for his consistent role as defender of fundamental American liberties. Also, the popular song hits include Nature Boy and Call It Stormy Monday. Okay, 1983, Maury Bishop, Unison Whiteman, and Jackie Carruth and other leaders of the Grenada Revolution were murdered in the coup. Also on this date in 1986, Samora Machel, Prime Minister of Mozambique, is killed when his airplane crashes mysteriously at the mountains of Zania, South Africa, in 1986. So I look at it being an assassination. In 1981, Gaddafi Abdel-Shakir was born. Gaddafi Abdel-Shakir is a new Arab revolutionary nationalist, a member of Georgia University, and a member of Black Ops Organizing Committee. On today, day 1898, North Carolina Mutual and Provident Insurance Company founded by John Merrick and associate in Durham, North Carolina. Also, on August 20th, Joe Makinya, leader of the Mamba Liberation Force and President of Kenya, were born. Mamba gained the independence in the 50s. You know what I'm saying? And Mamba stands for Land of Freedom Army, which is a Kenyan force. They had different oaths that deal with different aspects of things that are living, and they fought and resisted the Europeans to gain their independence. In 1942, 60 leading Southern Blacks issued Durham Manifesto called a Fundamental Training Revolution after the Durham, North Carolina meeting. In 1981, in Nyack, New York, Brinks robbery by black liberation ally anti-imperialists. October 21st, 1837, U.S. forces violated a flag of truce and arrested Seminole Chief Oscar Leo, who led a mixed Indian and black force and who was close identified with the struggle of runaway slaves. He died in prison on January 30, 1838. 1936, Jesse Owens, who was an athlete, won 4 gold medals at Berlin Olympics. In 1932, they started the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, which hundreds of black men were left untreated for a year by government researchers. 1963, in Folsom Prison, a strike protesting 4 cents a wage. October 22, 1906, 3,000 black demonstrators arrived in Philadelphia to protest an anti-black theatrical presentation of Tom Dixon, the Klansman. In 1906, 62 black reported lynched. 1963, some 225,000 students boycotted Chicago schools in Freedom Day protest of de facto segregation. They didn't want any new African coming to the school. Also on the 22nd, the National Day Against Police Brutality, is the United States Day. You know, we've been experiencing police brutality since we've been here. October 23rd, 1775. The Continental Congress approved a resolution barring blacks from the army. 1945, Brooklyn Dodgers signed Jackie Robinson and sent him to his leading farm club, the Montreal Royals, in the International League. 1947, NAACP petition on racism and appeal to the world presented the United Nations at Lake Success. I would say like free land to all those living in private land, revolutionary ingredients, free all the captured citizens. New African political prison, new African POW, free out of political prisons. I want to thank everybody who's been educating themselves in their community, educating themselves as an individual who are better themselves. Thank everybody who's been listening to our broadcast in 2014. I thank the people who followed and saluted. I thank all the students at Georgia University who currently educate themselves and better themselves. You know, and welcome to our show tonight, Brother Darryl Rachel. How you doing, good brother? You there, brother? How you doing, Darryl? How you doing, brother Darryl? What's going on? You hear me good, brother?
What the hell? Man, it's wild, man. Hold up. Hello.
Okay. All right. Welcome to the show. Yo, okay. Welcome to the show, Darryl Jordan. Sorry for technical difference. Go ahead, brother. How you doing tonight, brother?
Can you hear me? I'm doing all right.
Yes, sir. I'm doing well, brother. I'm doing well. Before we start this, can you tell us a little people, introduce yourself, tell a little people about yourself, who you are, before we get into the meat of the conversation?
Okay. My name is Darryl Jordan. I live in Detroit. Father of two daughters and got three grandchildren, and have been working as an organizer, been an organizer and an activist since 1978, really, when I moved to Detroit.
Okay. That's a good thing. In regards to being an organizer, activist, can you tell us, what's your definition of organizer? What's your definition of an organizer? What's your definition of an activist? What's the definition of that?
Okay, for me, an organizer is not just someone who's paid to do the job of educating and getting our folks together in the community. But a lot of times we have natural organizers who are just really active within their churches, communities, blocks, all kinds of social clubs and all that kind of stuff. And so organizers are people who find out what's going on and connect with people and get them to do something to help make things better. And this right now is a really hard time for us right now, politically, socially, economically. 2 years into this pandemic, and black communities are suffering all over. And a lot of that is because the majority of our community aren't getting the real information about what's going on. I'm going to say something that's going to sound crazy, but it'll tell the old people from the young people. And that's a long time ago, everybody used to pretty much get a newspaper every day. And then we used to have news on TV that used to at least give you an idea of some of what was going on. And now almost nobody buys a newspaper to see what's going on. I know I don't. And most of the time we get our information from social media, which means that we're pretty much talking to the same people that's thinking just like us. We are getting a little bit from the TV where they mention something, but they don't give you any real information. And so right now organizing has to be understood about trying to understand what's going on and connecting to the people in the community. We need to go back to thinking about the black community as a family, like back in the old days, you know, way back in the old days. And that was when folks knew each other and had a sense of what was going on, and they talked to each other. The community was like a family. And for a lot of us, if we were to have a family dinner right now, everybody might not agree with everything that we believe in and saying right now at the table. But everybody will listen to you and engage you, challenge you, criticize you. That's because in a family you have trust. And so we need to begin to develop and build community again and family where we might not agree with each other and we might not like everybody, but we'll love each other and understand that we got to work for each other or we're going to all suffer. I know that made, I was just talking on that, and I hope that made some sense.
Yeah, that actually made a lot of sense. I still want you to add, the other question was, what's your definition of an activist?
An activist is somebody who's willing to do whatever they're being asked to help build power in the community. You know, participate in campaigns. I'm saying that because a lot of folks in our community, they got children, they got responsibilities, they got a lot going on. But if folks who see themselves as activists and organizers can just give them a sense of what we need folks to do and when we need them to do it, then we'll see a lot more participation from people in our community in terms of just making some noise and letting folks know we're not okay with the stuff that's going down. One of the things I want to talk about is environment. And, you know, everybody's talking about environment and climate change right now. And the black community has been impacted and suffering from the point that they brought us over here as slaves, you know, in regards to where they put us, in regards to the land, in regards to some of the water and stuff that we had to figure out how to use. And that's still going on even right now. But we got to understand that in the black community, long before the environmental climate change movement, which is predominantly white, was talking about what was needed to be done, our communities was busy trying to figure out how to survive and how to make things better and how to clean the stuff up. And we're still in that same process, but our communities are usually ignored in regards to getting the kind of resources to do the work we need. And then we end up being the most impacted, even right now, when you begin to look around the country and you begin to see the places near the factories and the places where which is putting bad stuff in the air, incinerators, you find that mostly the population is black and other poor people, you know? And then when you began to look at who's making a lot of noise and talking about what they need, it's primarily the white-led movements at the same time, and many of them are working with the same folks that are exploiting our communities, like some of these big power companies and stuff. You know, they're acting like they're trying to do something to make things better, but at the same time, they're still making lots of money, you know, because for them, this is about business. This isn't about having the energy we need to do the things we need to do and to have a world that's still here when our great-great-great-great-grandchildren are born, you know, and they're not in a place where it's been so messed up that we began to see the end of the world.
True indeed, you know. That's an interesting take because I was just recently looking at something earlier today about the lead poison crisis in Benton Harbor, Michigan, right? And I also understand that there's been a water crisis in Detroit going on for years, right? That hasn't been resolved, right? What actually are your thoughts on that and how are the people being, how are the conditions in regards to the water right now in Detroit and what's really going on for the people who don't know?
I'm glad.
You know, we don't know because we're not there. We don't know what's going on, actually, because it's not being televised or anything like that, right?
Yep. That's the way they keep us all divided and isolated and not informed about how we can support each other. Now, the water situation in Benton Harbor, the lead, the folks have been complaining about that for a while there, but all of a sudden now it's hit the national media. And this isn't anything new to Michigan. Remember Flint, Michigan? And these water situations aren't natural disasters. I want to put that out there straight up. In Michigan, they started a process where governors could put in place emergency managers. And emergency managers have been used in all the black cities, black majority cities, and only one real working class white community way out from Detroit. But when an emergency manager is put in place, they have the power over your city council, over your school board, over all of that. You know, you put somebody in place to make decisions. So way back in the day, Detroit had an emergency manager, and Flint had an emergency manager. And so both of them were black. They worked for this big law company. And so the one in Flint wanted a deal because they wanted to pay less money because they were trying to develop a connection to a new water system that was being developed. And so the guy in Detroit said no. And so the guy in Flint decided to use the Flint River. Now, if that guy had just took his telephone and Googled the Flint River, he would have known that 10 years early, General Motors stopped using the Flint River because it was corroding the auto parts. You know, when the auto parts come down, the little factory thing, and they're really hot, you know, and the water goes across them. And so they were corroding the auto parts. And so General Motors stopped using the Flint River. But this emergency manager, he started using the water from the Flint River, and all of a sudden people began to lose hair, get sick, the water looked bad, and they were coming back and forth to Detroit for about 3 years to a group called the Detroit People's Water Board, showing big jars of nasty water and talking about what was going on. And it took a long time before the state of Michigan got pushed up to where they had to do something. And here again in Michigan, we're dealing with another similar situation out there in Benton Harbor, where those people were concerned too. Now, I bet you if that was Grosse Pointe, one of the very white, very well-to-do upper-class communities, I bet you they would have jumped. But when we're talking about majority black communities, predominantly poor, then folks act like they don't exist. And so this isn't just a water situation. This is continuous genocide, you know?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And
indeed.
I should add to that. If I could add to that real quick, Detroit, the city used to own the Detroit water system. And when Coleman Young became mayor, white racist guy, he died now. His name is Brooks Patterson out there in the next county. They began to organize against the Detroit water system. And now there's a regional Detroit water system, which is run by a majority of suburban communities that sit on the board. But Detroit is still the real owner of the water system. This is an example of if you had a car and I could drive it around and all I had to do was put gas in it and everything, but if something happened to the engine or the transmission, then I'd bring it back to you and you would have to fix it. You know, that's sort of like how the water system works here. A regional water system makes decisions, but if something goes bad, the people of Detroit, the taxpayers, have to pay for it. This is the blackest city, one of the blackest cities in the country.
Okay. My question was, in regards to you coming to Detroit, did you come to Detroit as a worker for General Motors, or you came to Detroit for another reason in particular?
When I came to Detroit in 1978, I had graduated from college and I was hanging out and having a good time. But I majored in political science, and so I hadn't found a job based on my major or anything. And so I was substitute teaching because my mother and my aunt worked in the school system. They got me a job, and that was killing me. And so I ran into some Vista and Peace Corps people at a food court in a mall and was talking to them. And so I decided to check it out and see what would happen. And so I got sent as a Vista volunteer to Detroit. And I was lucky enough to be sent to work for the Detroit Anti-Hunger Youth Advocacy Center. And this was a project run by a woman named Margaret Percy. Rest in peace. She's up in heaven with the ancestors now. And back then, there were a whole lot of folks who had come together to figure out how to deal with some of the issues in the community. And hunger was a big problem in Detroit at that time. And so she had me trained to be an organizer and to train young people to be organizers. And my trainer was a brother named Fundichi Impatanichi. He's still in Chicago, still organizing, making a lot of good stuff happen. He was my trainer and mentor. And so our job was to take these young people and train them to go door to door and talk to people in the community and find out what the problems were, if they needed food stamps, that other kind of stuff, and hook them up. But at the same time, we was connected to the politics of why there was hunger like this, you know, in the richest country in the world. And so we were putting out our little newspapers and other kinds of stuff and challenging the grocery stores that had stinky meats and other kinds of stuff. And so that was my first introduction to Detroit. And so that was hanging out in the community, going to the stores, meeting the people, both activists, regular residents, and other organizers. And so that was a great beginning here. A lot of those same problems still exist now, but they're a little different. at that same time, while I was working for a group that was going door to door, that was also a time when there was an organization called Operation Get Down. It was one of three or four black institutional community centers that did a whole lot of the work to make Detroit fight back and resist some of the stuff that was going on. And so Operation Get Down became a huge food co-op at one point. You know, they had young people who were organizing around black nationalism, but at the same time they were in the community and they had built a food co-op that at one point was the biggest food co-op, urban food co-op in the country. And if you're wondering what's happening to a lot of that work and organizing in Detroit because of the power that black people tried to bring together at one point, there's been a continuous 50-year war against black folks here in regards to both the black institutions and a lot of the issues of hunger and other stuff that's still here, even though there's organizations working on it, gentrification. You know, we've been 2 years into the pandemic, and there's still people in Detroit that don't have water, you know. At one point, we had almost 15,000 households that didn't have water, and this was an economic issue because the water bills were so high, and so a lot of people didn't have water. Then the pandemic started, and the governor of Michigan and the mayor here, they started acting like they were about saving the people and they were about getting the water cut on. But we still have households and people in Detroit that don't have water. Let me slow down.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's understood. Yeah, it's really crazy. You know, I would like to ask you, what other organizations contributed to the hunger aspect, finding people getting food, and basically, my next question is, what types of struggle did you face in regard to getting the information out there? Struggle you get in regard to getting food? What type of adversity did you face in regards to that? Okay, and how did the people respond to certain situations to the hunger?
You know, our people figure out how to make the best out of any situation. And at that time in 78, when I first got here, there were a lot of the big grocery stores had left the city. And so a lot of those grocery stores were now being taken over by the influx of Chaldean and Arab store owners. And they were coming, and while they might have been just learning how to run the business, they were taking advantage of in our community of selling meats that smelt bad and all kinds of other stuff. And so in regards to connecting with the community and letting them know what they was already figuring out for themselves and letting folks know where they could get something else, you know, we would have three or four stores in there with 10 items in. Figure out how much they cost. At the same time, we talk about going in there and seeing what the meats and stuff look like. And so that plus other more political information about issues going on in the community and internationally, like world hunger and other stuff, well, folks were glad to connect with us. You know, and just like now, the organization I work for now, East Michigan Environmental Action Council, well, actually, I just retired, but I'm still out in the street with the street team, which is a group of young people between the ages of 13 and 21. And so we out there going door to door with lots of information from lots of different organizations, letting them know what's going on and what they can do about it, what they need them to do. And so people will engage with them and take the information, because right now don't nobody really know what's going on, you know, because of the pandemic. They're not really getting out. People not really sharing a lot of information. They pretty much home taking care of themselves and their family. And so we get good interaction, and that's the same thing as in the old days. When we look at our history, you know, look at the organizations like the Black Panther Party and SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. In the communities they were working in, there were people who didn't understand exactly what they were trying to do, and some people didn't agree with them and stuff. But the majority of the people always supported them because they trusted them. And that's what we got to get to in regards to our organizing these days. We got to get back out there in the community and engage and connect with the people. So even if they don't fully understand what we're talking about, they'll engage with us and try to figure out, ask questions, read some other stuff, criticize us if they think we're wrong. And if we engage them, then we'll find out that we began to build a lot of support. And that's how you build power in the community, because right now they keep taking advantage of our community in regards to voting and everything else. You know, while they'll use the problems that are impacting the black community to talk about the need, but when the resources come through to address the need, everybody gets more than they need to do what they need to do, except for the black community, which ends up usually with less of the things that we need to make things better.
Yes, sir. It's always an attack on the community and all that, and all the slavers. You mentioned VISTA. What exactly is VISTA? Is it an acronym or organization?
Yes.
What exactly is it?
Yeah, VISTA was Volunteers in Service to America. You know, that was part of the Peace Corps, you know, but when I ran into them, the choice of going in the Peace Corps and going outside the country or going somewhere inside the U.S., I had grown up in the state of Virginia in a place called Portsmouth, Virginia. And so, you know, I went to college in Virginia State College in Petersburg, Virginia. And so I didn't think that I was ready to go outside the country, if you understand what I mean. You know, and I wasn't about trying to join the military and stuff, because I grew up like three blocks from the Norfolk Naval Shipyard, which is one of the largest U.S. shipyards in the country. So even before I became political, I was already anti-military, if that make any sense.
That's
sort of like where I came from. And so when I got an opportunity to go somewhere else, I took the opportunity and I lucked up and came to Detroit. And it was an interesting time at that period, too, in 78, 79, early 80s. I mentioned Operation Get Down, but we had another place here called Inner City Sub Center, which was another black institution. And they used to always have these public gatherings where speakers would come and talk about the issues, you know. So everybody would come through, you know, anybody you can think of. But, you know, the Detroiters that were here, if Queen Mother Moore would come to town, then she would be there speaking, and everybody would come, you know. But then we would always have Wells, because he lived there in Detroit, you know. And so just being around so that you could hear Anwar Pasha, Papa Wells, talk about when he was young and organizing in Detroit, and he was one of the 12 that had studied under Master Farad, you know, and that Elijah Muhammad had went on to Chicago and created the black Muslims. You know, but just to be around people who could tell those stories and stuff, you know, it was unbelievable, you know. And so for being young and coming here, it wasn't just an opportunity that we was in the street, but the opportunity to be exposed to people who were talking about the issues we had to deal with and some of the solutions and some of the suggestions of the things that we needed to be doing. It was really a great time to come here and stuff. And so I consider myself very blessed and lucky in that respect, because I think the career that I've had is organizing is not just because of the work that I did when I got here, but also the things that the people I got exposed to and the history just here in Detroit, you know. And so those kinds of things come together, and they kind of gave me an opportunity to have an unbelievable organizing career over the last 40-some years. And I think for organizers, no matter who you are and where you are, I think we all have to figure out how to be us and be comfortable and enjoy what we're doing and then engage with the people we can engage with and tell them what's going on and make the connections to our issues. You know, the big movements, the big national majority white-led movements, they always talking about intersectionality between the issues. Well, for most of us, the intersectionality was always understood, you know, because everything we're dealing with pretty much comes from having to fight and resist white supremacy, you know. That's why we ended up here, and that's why we continue to fight for our survival and fight for things to get better. But now we're dealing with some issues which isn't just about us. And so all these capitalists continue to make all this money, and all these people, all these big companies want to continue to make decisions looking like they're trying to do something about nature and the world and the water and the air, and they're not really doing that but making more money. But it's not just going to affect us anymore. You know, it's going to affect every community in this world. And so we need to speak up and connect with all those other communities in other countries and other places and let folks know that we're tired of these racist capitalists are just making money at the expense of all kinds of people. You know, and even though they have a lot of white people thinking that they count, they don't count neither, you know. They gonna kill all of us because this is about making money, you know. That's why we came here as slaves, and that's why they continue to kill us. They want to make money.
True indeed. You mentioned Mayor Coleman Young. Who exactly is that?
Mayor Coleman Young was the first black mayor of Detroit. And when he came into power here in Detroit in 74, I mean, you know, it was like bringing together a lot of black movements, a lot of black organizations, a lot of black communities and stuff. Everybody backed him up, you know, because he talked a lot of trash. You know, he was very progressive, socialist leaning. He was in the union, big time union rep, and so he was managed to pull that together and come into power. And he came into power, and all of a sudden, every white suburb, everybody began to fight Detroit and try to take it apart, because we were a majority black city then. And, you know, the people had already started to try to take Detroit apart after the 67 rebellion. And so, you know, a lot of those corporations and stuff were trying to take back control. But Coleman was trying to build up black businesses and change some of the things that black communities had been suffering from. You know, there was a unit here, a police unit called STRESS. And STRESS was one of the pilots. One of the early things like COINTELPRO. But when Coleman Young came to power, he told them suckers to get beyond 8 Mile, which meant to get out of Detroit, so he got rid of that. But at the same time, he stayed in power so long that he got it in some ways too. But in some ways in the very beginning, it was about seeing what black self-determination could look like. You know, like one of the things that he did was everybody was beginning to get cable in all the large cities around the country, you know. But in Detroit, we didn't have cable. And so when Detroit got challenged, Coleman Young said Detroit wouldn't get cable until a black man could hook it up. And so that was when Barton Cable got created, you know. Barton was a black construction guy that him and a bunch of construction folks had pooled their money, and they had backed Coleman all the time. And so he went off and got trained and came back and started Barton Cable, you know, that made a lot of money here and eventually got sold to Comcast. But Barton also had Barton Casino down there in old Las Vegas, Nevada. You know, and that came from the money that he made because he became the first black cable company in the country, you know. And I know some of that was black capitalism, I mean, you know, but some of it was just throwing his thumb up at the white folks saying, screw you. I know some of this sounds crazy, but, you know, that's pretty much what happened here. And so Coleman did a lot of stuff. And so dealing with, like, the hunger issue, he created a group of people who were grassroots organizers. Some of them were preachers. A lot of them were running organizations, like the woman I had worked for at the Detroit Anti-Hunger Program. Margaret Bertie was a part of that. And a woman named Marion Kramer, who was running Welfare Rights Movement. And she was a longtime organizer and was married to a brother named General Baker here. And General Baker was one of the founders of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, where the brothers and stuff came together that had their nasty jobs in Chrysler and them other auto plants came together. And they were just out of high school, got them jobs there. And so it was just like the young folks that went to college and joined SNCC, the young brothers and sisters that in the community had joined the Panthers. And so they turned the union movement inside out here, you know. And so it was people like that that were on this task force on hunger and malnutrition. And their job was to figure out what we needed to do to make sure that people was getting food and people was getting the resources that they needed. And so he also put institutions like that together to begin to challenge some of the ways that folks had begun to come after Detroit. And a lot of work went into trying to work on the Detroit educational system, too, even though if you remember when we were talking about water, I talked about the emergency managers. Well, the governors of Michigan used the emergency managers to take apart the Detroit education system here, and we're still struggling. Talking too crazy and just too all about, just to slow me down.
No, brother. No, I'm saying, bro, you're giving a clear understanding in regards to what's going on. You articulate yourself very well, and you're being very informative, which is all we needed, you know, for the mass. Because we understand that education for liberation, and if we also understand that it should be used as a weapon. It is a weapon for us, or a weapon against us. They've been utilized to enslave us mentally through our scary teachings. And our scary teacher basically teaching that they want us to learn what they want to teach us about certain things in regards to our education, our politics, our history, our origin, identity, and so forth and so on, right? So you basically giving a full good understanding of your experiences and what was actually going on. You know, you're giving a good account of history, you know, in regard to the situation, right? You
and
know, which is a beautiful thing. We all need that.
And right now, the issues that we're dealing with, they're keeping us separated and isolated from each other. And, you know, while it's very important for us to fight back in regards to the police killings, and so we understand Black Lives Matter, but Black Lives Matter also when they began to kill us with the dirty water, you know, and the dirty air. You know, when you began to look at some of the communities that we're talking about, then you began to look at our health issues and you began to understand that we have huge numbers of young people with asthma, you know, in areas where they are incinerators and where these factories are putting bad air out, and you know. And then where the water is bad, like in Flint and Detroit and other places and stuff, you find out that a lot of people are dealing with a whole lot of issues, you know, cancer, high blood pressure, all these kinds of things. And so we need to be out here raising these issues and connecting with each other. So we understand that everything is connected because the same people making the same kind of money and stuff are making the decisions that are killing us all these kinds of ways. And so we need to go back to the days when we began to talk to each other. And like I say, we need to get back to where we don't always have to agree and we always don't have to understand. But if we begin to get back to just loving and appreciating each other as Black people, then at least we get to the point that we can trust each other, you know? And we need to do that right now because these aren't issues just of whether or not we're going to get control of the area we live in. Now some of the issues we're dealing with are having to do with whether or not our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to have a world to live in. Anywhere like what we live in, are they going to be suffering because the air is going to be worse and the water is going to be more poison and stuff, you know, like other third world areas are suffering right now. Many parts of the United States are dealing with some of the same issues, you know. And water is an issue in all kinds of cities, Jackson, Mississippi. We can just start naming cities, and, you know, everybody got these issues. And a lot of these issues aren't really natural issues. It's a lot of the issues around water have to do also with these corporations making money. And so while water is life, and we understand that people can't survive without drinking water, water has become a corporate business, and that's the way they act, and that's the way they treat it. And so they're about making big, 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 big money at the expense of the people who need the product, you know. And while we might Pepsi Cola, you know, we don't have to drink no Pepsi Cola, you know. We'll do all right if we leave that alone. We'll be healthier. But, you know, we can't do that about water. If you're not drinking water, you're going to die, you know. And so we've got to come together, and we've got to not just fight to clean up the water, but we got to fight to end some of this corporate and capitalist control over some of the natural resources that we have to have, you know. Electricity, we have to have electricity. And while there's technology where you can use solar energy, now the corporate companies that are making money off coal and electricity and other stuff, now they're taking control over the industry and putting restrictions out there because they give so much money to the elected officials that they'll do anything they want. So now they're controlling the solar industry to some degree. And so they're making it hard. Like, if you and I decided that we wanted to put solar panels on our house to cut down on our electric bill, in some places they would make that impossible, you know? And so we got to figure out how to come together and understand that we got to be battling capitalist control over the things that we need to survive. And we need to be making the connections between the issues that impact the health of the people in our community. And we need to understand how all these things have some bearing, you know, and that none of this stuff is new, you know. And we need to let folks know that while everybody's acting like things are getting better, things aren't getting better. You know, some of the things that we're talking about, real survival, and trying to take best care of our families, we need to look at what's really happening. Like some of the responses to the uprisings after the murder of George Floyd and all our other brothers and sisters that have been killed by the police, all of a sudden all these corporations and a lot of the institutions in our country want to act like all of a sudden they're anti-racist. You know, but if we began to look and see what they're doing, like it, General Motors and them auto industries here in Detroit. And so they went downtown and painted in the street Black Power, Black Lives Matter. You know, now that's cool to be written in the street, you know, but if that's not going to make life better for black folks here in Detroit, if they're going to still be using their money to help gentrify and make sure that a white mayor that won by writing in votes and have been kept in because of the corporate money that keeps them in, then, you know, this slogan on the streets is not really doing anything to change black people's lives and our future. I mean, you know, and I'm cool if folks don't agree with me. But, you know, if General Motors and those automobile companies wanted to really do something, then they'd be doing something to keep that pollution that Chrysler is putting in the community over there impacting senior black people and toddlers, little kids with their respiratory stuff because of the stuff they're putting in the air, you know. Maybe they would do something to give better jobs to some of the brothers and sisters who live right there in the community, not far from the plants and stuff, you know, rather than hiring a lot of folks who come from the suburbs, you know. And then they could do all of that and put a slogan in the street, then that would be great, you know. But we need to be calling these folks out for what they're really doing and stop them from exploiting our community and making so much money off the impact of the issues that we had to deal with.
True indeed. You know, I will ask you what type of environment or program that were taking place or have been taking place that you've been engaged to or knew about that dealt with smog and air pollution in the communities. I will ask you about that, you know, because...
You know, I had mentioned that we have a group of young people. We call it our street team. And so there was an incinerator in Detroit that there was a struggle that had been going on for 33 years. And they finally closed this incinerator down last year. And the reason, well, 2 years ago. And the reason it got shut down was after all those years and stuff, the incinerator was over there behind apartments and communities that pretty much was black. Then you began to build apartment complexes that had black senior citizens. And then you had apartment complexes that had young families and lots of children. And then you had students with apartments that were going to Wayne State, you know. And so the community was a lot of college students were in and out. A lot of the older people were just trying to survive. Some of them had to decide when they go out to get groceries based on when the stuff was put in the air, you know, because it could make you start, you know, you're breathing really hard and stuff. And so during the last about 6 years or so, after the Social Forum came here, the U.S. Social Forum came to Detroit in 2010, I think. Folks started making a lot of noise about the incinerator. And so then the newspapers start putting information there. And so the young people that work for us, about 2.5 years ago, we started hitting all the communities with information about the incinerator and had meetings with the senior citizens in the senior buildings and stuff, so that they could tell people what was going on. And so that kind of gossip and the stuff in the newspapers and on social media and other stuff, that made so much noise that these gentrifying developers in Midtown Detroit, the area of Midtown Detroit used to be called Cass Corridor, but they changed it to Midtown because Cass Corridor used to be an area where at one point it was pretty progressive, but at the same time, they also had institutions for like abortion, family care, and for taking care of the homeless and the needy. And so, you know, when they started gentrifying, they wanted to get rid of all of that, you know, so they changed the name to Midtown. But when the information about the incinerator and how it was impacting people who live anywhere near it start really getting out and getting covered statewide and nationally, it became very hard for these multi-millionaire and billionaire developers to sell these overpriced buildings in Midtown. And so that was what happened, where people came together and contributed to forcing them people to shut down the incinerator. Now, you know, we still got to deal with people needing to get some help about some of the health issues that have been affected because of them living near that incinerator over the years. But at least it's closed down now, and so it can't keep adding to the misery and the health problems of the folks in our community. You know, so that's like one big issue that was going on here. And then, like you said, water. And water turnoffs was an issue here in Detroit, not the poison water like was in Flint in Benton Harbor. Here in Detroit, it was about water, you know, and it was about the cost of water. And so the high cost of water had caused many families to not be able to pay their water bill. And so in response to that, they began to cut off people's water. And that's why when the pandemic started, we had about 12,000 people who didn't have any water, you know, and 10 years before that, people have been doing all kinds of demonstrations and stuff trying to get the water cut on. As a matter of fact, there was a sister named Charity Hicks, and she was an organizer here in Detroit, and she was one of many different organizers who were doing all kinds of demonstrations to block the people from cutting off water and doing all kinds of stuff. And she was invited to go to the UN in New York to speak about the water situation in Detroit so that they could make the connections to the same kind of stuff that was going on internationally. And on her way to New York, she was murdered by this guy who turned out to be a kid of some high New York police official. Now, I don't know whether he ever went to jail or not. I need to look that up. But, you know, some people want to say that's a coincidence. And now I don't want to sound all conspiratorial or anything. But, you know, stuff like this have happened in black communities and in our history over and over and over and over again, you know. She was going to speak internationally to let people know what the cost of water and how the corporate capitalist running of this water company was impacting thousands of families in this city, you know. And so Charity Hicks, rest in peace, one of our ancestors up there. You know, she wasn't just active around water. She was very much involved with the people who began to put together and organize the Black Detroit Black Food Security Network, you know, and D-Town Farms, you know, a movement and a group led by Brother Malik Yakini, which is one of the most amazing and largest urban agricultural movements in the country, you know, both helping other folks to get started and have been going here for years, you know, in regards to trying to deal with the hunger issues and the food problems in Detroit.
Okay. When you were organizing, did you happen to meet Chokwe Lumumba during that time? Did you meet him?
Oh man! Back in the day, when Chokwe was here in Detroit and going around, there was a joke some of us used to have back in the day, because there would be so many young brothers and sisters following him around, you know, young law students and stuff. It would be like the Pied Piper and stuff, man. You know, so they just wasn't following him around. You know, he was putting them to work, you know. Back in the day when shooting down black people in some of these small Chaldean stores was going on, you know, when you got the call that something happened, and Chokwe was calling people to go stand in front of the store. Back in them days, you know, everybody wasn't from the same organization, not necessarily at the same level of political understanding and stuff. But because of who he wasn't just a revolutionary that could talk revolutionary, you know. What's the old saying? You got to talk it and, you know, not just walk it, talk, you know, not just talk it, walk it. You know, he lived it, you know, and so when he called people to do something, or he was somewhere, you was around him, you were just motivated, you know. And that's an organizer, you know, and he kept stuff going, you know, and you know, he went on and just made so many contributions to the movement and stuff, you know. But the work that he did locally and the inspiration and the inspiring and taking care of folks that he did here added to development of many people who are still in the movement. Yeah, man. It's just so many contributions that so many people have made here. You know, Detroit was a center for black organizing, you know, all the way back to the beginning of the Nation of Islam, to the Shrine of the Black Madonna, you know, Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, and the other Revolutionary Union Movement that was in the other factories. There were so many groups that that grew here in Detroit. Still here.
The Republic of New Africa.
The Republic of New Africa. Which very much started here, in the church situation that started here, because a lot of folks don't understand that the leaders of the Republic of New Africa and the leaders of the NAACP and the Jimmy Boggs from Grace and Jimmy, who is married to Grace Boggs. I mean, you know, the spectrum was so wide in terms of how people interacted and worked with each other that Detroit was unbelievable in regards to both the connections, because back then organizing was about relationship building. And in regards to relationship building, that contributed to the movement that both created the Republican New Africa, that brought Coleman Young to power, and that continues to keep Detroit struggling for self-determination no matter what's going on. Because Kwaisi and them still keep the movement going here in regards to connecting with campaigns and struggles and organizations and communities in regards to trying to keep people organizing and at least knowing what's going on.
True indeed. You know, throughout your organizing, what were some of the more difficult things that you don't face in regard to organizing, and what were some of the more easier things that you face while organizing?
I think that in regards to sometimes the success that we have in organizing end up getting blown away in some respects in terms of trying to move toward the goals and objectives we're trying to get to. And I want to speak about the 1991 People of Color Environmental Climate Change Gathering that happened. It brought together all kinds of folks, you know, and they came together and that changed the whole environmental movement, because before that, you know, the white people was having Earth Day and other kinds of stuff. But in return to grassroots communities and connecting the issues to our people and coming together and trying to figure out what we needed to do to make things better, it hadn't happened. But when people of color came together, it began to scare the white predominantly environmental movement and the U.S. structure. Because when the people came together that created that movement, they were connected to wider struggles in the black community, you know. Every organization you could think of back then was connected to coming to that meeting, you know. And one of the organizers, the main organizer, was Ben Chavis, who was coming from the Church of Christ at that point, you know. And in North Carolina, where a lot of the big ruckus started around environmental stuff was because those big corporations decided to put some poisonous stuff in the ground, and they went to do it in North Carolina. And it brought together everybody from members of the RNA to the NAACP to all kinds of churches and stuff. Because at that point, it wasn't about politics or where you were. It was about they trying to kill us. And so folks came together, and so that became a big part of the black environmental movement. You know, people like Bahati, Dr. Mildred McLean down there in Savannah, Georgia, who've been doing this stuff forever. You know, people began to come together and say what we had to do. But because of the connections in regards to the black community, in regards to connections to the anti-apartheid movement, in regards to the movement for self-determination and into all kinds of movements to make things better in the black community and for the Latino community, because those people also represented not just farmers who were being poisoned, farm workers being poisoned because of the stuff they were using to grow the stuff, but because a lot of them organizers and activists were also very active in regards to the anti-Central America infiltration and exploitation by the U.S. at that point. They were Puerto Rican independent people. They were Cuban supporters of that revolution. And then you had indigenous people who were who had been continuously poisoned ever since those Europeans come here, poisoning their water and doing other kinds of stuff. And so they were standing at the table, but they were also making other issues about connecting to indigenous people in the South and Central America and in other places around the world. And then you had the Asians who were mad as hell, because even though some people didn't understand why they were so mad, but on the West Coast, a lot of the Balawans and a lot of the folks from the Pacific Islands and from some of those huge Asian nations, they were being poisoned by the U.S. and other folks who wanted to leave their nuclear trash over there on these people's land and wanted, you know, to do all kinds of nuclear stuff around them, you know, with these big nuclear facilities acting like they were safe when they weren't. And so that scared the hell out of the people who were supposed to be our allies. And they began to work together to play us against all our communities against each other, and to play us against getting the resources that we needed to make some of the changes and do some of the organizing in our community. Now, that happened in 2003, because 10 years after 91, when they came back together, that's when folks played them against each other, because they were scared to death of when black folks come together and when black folks and other people of color come together and we dealing with the same issue and trying to survive. And so that's one thing that was very hard, because we thought we were actually doing something and making some progress, and then they played us against each other. And that's when we began to understand that just like they go against us in regards to trying to move and create black power and black governance, that they move against us when they think we're coming together to try to just make the air and the water and the stuff around us good. You know, they're scared of it because they know that as soon as we understand that the same ways of trying to keep us in our place and the same weapons that they use to become the richest capitalist country in the world, as long as they can keep us under control and exploited, that's what they're about. And they're so scared that when we come together and began to talk to each other and understand that we all dealing with the same struggle, then that scares the shit out of them. And every time the black community gets the worst end of the deal, that's because of, in terms of our numbers and our volume and our history, it scares the shit out of them. And even though, I'm sorry for that. And even though that's one of the issues and stuff, we know that we got some of our folks who've tried to mix in with the narrative so that they could operate in different parts of the corporate systems and stuff. But now a lot of those folks in the corporate society, they are creating real problems for our community too. So we need to call them out. You know, because if they're not going to be helpful, we need to call them out. It's not like 60 years ago when even though you had black people with business who got opportunities to work in corporate America and stuff, and black people who got to be policemen, they might have had a real messed up job, but they understood that they were still black folks and still part of the black community and the black family. But now they done got them so crazy and stretched out that we need to be clear in terms of criticizing and calling some of our folks out if they're on the wrong side. I hope some of that stuff I'm talking makes some sense and it don't just sound like I'm just going on and on and on talking. What'd you think, Brother Bomani? Am I making any sense?
Yeah, it making sense. One other thing I want to ask you, right? What do you think some of the most effective ways of organizing the conditions right now, according to your experience, right now, what's some of the best ways? I know things don't change throughout the decades and the time periods and the political climate. They ain't no change. So, what you think? What you feel is some of the most efficient way to organize now? Because you see, a lot of people are on social media and people call themselves, people want to organize on social media and start different things, you know, but what do you think the most efficient way to organize right now, from your standpoint?
I think that the most efficient thing we need to do is be going out in the community, connecting to the people that live out there in the community, going back to the old days of newsletters and newspapers and telling people what's up and what's going on, so that if they read what you're talking about and what you're doing, and they agree with you and they like what you're doing, they can figure out how to connect with you and support the work that you're doing. And even if they don't, then they become aware. So when the emergency come out, we need everybody. At least they know what's going on and they can come out. And the other big thing is when you're out there in the community, especially these last 2 years, because we've been out there with our street community, because the COVID shut everybody down and kept everybody home. And at one point, all the school kids had to do virtual and stay home and stuff. And you wouldn't believe how glad the community was to see us. And then we would carry out this magazine called Riverwise that's put out by the Boggs Center. And we would have information from a whole lot of organizations about what was going on, whether it was about the air, the water, the welfare rights movement, Detroit People's Platform, which has the slogan Majority Black Detroit. So any organization that had something that they needed to put out in that community, we was connecting with folks and letting them know when we was going out and telling them to get us the information. And so, like I said, that made the people in the community feel like they knew what was going on or they got more information about something that was happening than they knew already. And so, you know, even if they didn't know more or whatever, it felt good to be connected. And I think they felt good to be connected to people, too. And that's what being creating trust is about. And that's why I always use that example of SNCC and the Panther Party, because they had the support of a majority of the communities that they were in, even though all of the people might not agree with them or truly understood them. But that was because they trusted them more than they understood what was going on sometimes. And we got to get back to doing that, you know.
Okay, let me ask you a question.
When you came
to Detroit, at that time in 78, was there any functioning Black Panthers at that time? Any Black Panthers that were functioning at that time in particular? Or was there no Black Panther Party president at that time?
No, there was a lot of stuff going on here. Like I said, the inner city sub-center was a gathering place for all kinds of folks. And so we used to see Mario Bedelli and all kinds of folks who were the leaders of the huge movements and made huge contributions to our history. But they would be there both as participants and as speakers. And so all kinds of folks were there, you know, just like I mentioned, Anwar Pasha, Papa Wells, he was always there too, you know. And so all kinds of folks was at these meetings, you know. A brother named Bernard Parker was running the Operation Get Down at that time. And that was very much a part of the National Black Political Assembly that existed, that evolved into the National Black Political Party. And Detroit had a very active National Black Political Party in the late 70s, early 80s and stuff. That was a lot of bringing a lot of the Black community together. Everybody from every other organization was a part of the National Black Political Party. And then the movement in Gary, talking about contradictions in the movement in Gary, when the political assembly came together, I think that must have been 80 or something. No, it must have been 70s or something. I can't remember the date. But Coleman Young was part of the Detroit delegation. But because he was getting ready to run for office or something, the UAW exerted their control and they pulled out Coleman Young and the Black Union part of the movement, you know, the more moderate part of the union movement. But the more radical folks stayed. But the political assembly was very active at that time. And it was just an amazing time of the interaction of many different organizations. There was a sister, I'm trying to think of her name. She also had another Black institution. Some of the folks are still around. Sister Helen Moore is still around here raising holy hell about education here and stuff, you know. Detroit is just an amazing place. And the history of Black folks and Black movements is still very much alive, even though a lot of the young people now are moving us to new levels and new directions and new stuff, working on issues of healing and all kinds of things and using technology in ways that I can tell you I don't understand some of the use of the technology that's being used. And so I think that if our young folks and our old folks and all of us can come together and we can figure out how to begin to build relationships like the old days and connect the issues that we are concerned about and to go out in the community and figure out how to create gatherings and engagements and interactions with each other, I think we'll begin to build the power and the energy and the excitement that will begin to help make some change.
Yeah, so that sounds about right, man. Can you tell us about your relationship with the American Friends, American Friends Services Committee, and what they asked you about?
Yeah, the American Friends Service Committee is a Quaker organization, and it was started like in 1917, and so. It was one of those organizations where they were an anti-war organization, and they began to do a whole lot of work on a whole lot of issues. And so the organization, the anti-hunger program that I began to work for, even though it was run by black folks, it had gotten resources to operate and was connected to the service committee. And so that was my introduction to it. And eventually I ended up getting a job nationally with them as the coordinator first and then the director of the Third World Coalition, which was created in 1972 by when people of color came together and called the organization out on its racism. Not that it's still all these white organizations still are racist, and we need to be dealing with that, but it still offered opportunities for folks like myself to do work on issues that were very important to contributing to the movement to liberate black folks. And a lot of folks that many of you know and that were great friends of mine worked for the American Friends Service Committee. Sister Fulani Suni Ali, you know, she worked for the service committee down there in Atlanta on militarism issues long time ago, back in the 80s and stuff. A brother named Masai Hosi did prison work up in Newark and New York and stuff, you know, just lots of folks. And so the organization allowed a lot of us to come together and learn from each other and to connect movements and organizations and people that I never thought I would have met and got an opportunity to work with. And it also connected with us folks, connected many of us in the movements we were working on, connected us internationally and otherwise, and so that we could make contributions to try to make change, both getting our brothers and sisters out of prison, both changing the places and the ways we had to live, in regards to being poisoned by all kinds of stuff, water and other kinds of stuff, to avoiding the military, to all kinds of things. And so I had a job there working for about 20 years. I left there in about 2012. And one of the things that we were able to do there was to contribute to making the connection between the struggle of Palestinians in the Holy Land to black people over here. And so we were able to carry a delegation of people of color over there in 2008. And that even included my sister Fulani, who went. And then later on in 2012 was part of taking a delegation of all black people over there to Palestine too, so that we can make those connections, because a lot of times we end up in struggles with communities over here because communities of color, black and other communities of color, we know less about each other than we all know about white people, because we all have to survive this white system. And so if we're going to really change this system and get the kinds of freedom and liberation that we really want, we're going to have to figure out how to deal and get rid of this capitalist white supremacist system. And so that's why it scares them whenever people come together. But we've got to figure out how we do that. And so that also gave us opportunities to connect with people in other countries, whether we're talking about in Africa, South Africa, Zimbabwe, just everywhere, Guatemala, Cuba. Cuba is a big, big, big ally of the black community here. We need to appreciate and support ending the Cuban blockade because of the cost to Cuba as a country. But at the same time, they continue to give support and protection to our sister, the Asada, you know. And that's so very important because Cuba, even though it's one of the poorest countries over here in this part of the world, they figured out how to live like poor black people. You know, you might not have no resources, but just figure out how to make the best of your resources. So they've figured out how to have free health care for all, because they understand in Cuba that if everybody is going to the doctor and stuff, then you don't end up with these huge, huge, huge numbers of major diseases and other kinds of stuff, because you can deal with it as it comes. And then you have a situation where everybody over there has got a job. You know, everybody's got something, a responsibility. They got to work. Now, when the environment messes up and you can't work, you still get paid money so you can take care of your family and stuff. And everybody got a place to live. Now, it might not be the best place that you wanted to live and stuff, but at least they don't have homelessness over there. And everybody gets to eat. And over there, if you're a woman and you're pregnant and they can tell you're pregnant at a certain time, then if you go to a restaurant, you can only eat certain kinds of food. Now, I know that for some people that might sound pretty, that's too much in control and stuff. But for a poor country taking care of poor people with a huge amount of black people, they're doing all right there. Racism is illegal over there, even though you still got some issues where you still dealing with folks who trying to connect with the U.S. and the other bigger part of the world and want to be prejudiced. But Cuba is a good space, too. And so AFSC allows them, folks like myself, the opportunity to connect with black folks all over this country and all over the world and learn from that and be committed to struggling to organize and make change and liberate our folks until we can't do it no more. See, does that make any sense? I'm just talking.
Yes, sir. It made a lot of sense, man. Now, if an individual wanted to start organizing, what would you tell him or her for the first time? What would you tell them? What would you educate them to do, assist them in doing, or point them in direction of?
In regards to, first, if you want to organize around a particular issue, that means you already paid attention to something. So I would try to find out who's doing the work on that issue locally, and then look up and get as much information as you can about whatever it is you're concerned about. But organizing is about connecting with people personally, too, about one-on-one. And so the easiest way to start organizing is to start talking to the people that you connected with, the people that you hang around with, the people that you work with, the people that you are in the community with. You know, here in Detroit, they had a preliminary election not too long ago, a couple of months ago. There was a ballot initiative on the ballot, and the initiative was called Proposal P. And it was promoting solutions to all kinds of things, water affordability, dealing with the control of the neighborhood, gentrification, some of the environmental issues, some of the economic issues and stuff. They carried it to court. And so while it was in court, the corporate folks and the mayor started putting commercials on TV telling people to vote no. So by the time the court ruled on it and folks got the information and stuff, a lot of people didn't even know what was going on or what they had missed and stuff. And so that's how they could take advantage of us and stuff. And so in some of the reflection meetings after that, some of the candidates and the people pushing those issues, they were talking about what can we do to let people know. Well, back in the old days, they used to have, when Coleman Young was running for office, also when Kwame Kilpatrick ran for office, they used to have groups of cars that would go from bar to bar, you know, pool room to pool room. Kwame Kenyatta used to do that too when he ran for the county commission and the city council. And so even though you be connecting with regular people in the community you might not know or hang out with, but once they get a sense of who you are and you're trying to do something, you know, then they begin to figure out that maybe they should do something to support you or find out more what you're talking about. And so it becomes really important to just connect with, speak to, and engage the people around you and tell them about what you think is important and what they need to be paying attention to. But talk to them in a way that they understand. Because, you know, a lot of people talk about environmental issues. And so a lot of people have been trained lately from the universities on how to organize around environmental issues. And so when you go out there, a lot of people don't understand what you're talking about. But if you can figure out how to connect with those people around those same issues and translate the information so that they understand what you're talking about, then you begin to find out that the people in the community trust you and appreciate the fact that you're helping them to understand what's going on so they can better take care of themselves, their family, and their community. Does that make any sense?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It made a whole lot of sense, man. This is another question I have, right? I understand. I also don't talk to somebody else who worked for Vista, right? And Vista has the capacity to organize, get people to teach people how to organize. Now, in regards to the organizing that Vista has, and the organizing they're doing unions, is it the same type of organization, or is it even similar, or is it different in regards to each other?
It was different. Vista, they would just send you to an organization, and then the organization was responsible for the work that you had to do and how you did it. And the union, even though they send you out to organize people and to work on the issues and stuff, you had to deal with some of the racism. So I worked for Local 79, which organized primarily hospitals and nursing homes, you know? That was a cool job. Only thing, you got to go out and you got to talk to the majority of the people who worked for the nursing homes are women. And so it wasn't a problem so much inside the city of Detroit. But when they started sending me to the suburbs, because of a lot of our sisters and brothers too, they had to drive out to the suburbs and work for some of those bigger nursing homes and hospitals and stuff. And so one of the issues you began to deal with is that as a black person driving around in the suburb, the police stop you forever and ever and ever, you know. So I got continually stopped out there trying to go to nursing homes and talk to workers and stuff. And so the racism you had to deal with, but not just the external racism that came because you had black people out there in areas that they knew they could figure out what you was doing because you was talking to the workers and you weren't working there. You also had the issue of the internal control of the unions and stuff, where even though sometimes you had black leaders in terms of being organizers in the workplaces and stuff, the control at the higher levels, at the international level, was controlled by the white folks who were trying to make sure that they could be political, and that way they couldn't make it look like black people were in control. So you needed institutions like the Coalition of Black Trade Unions and other folks to help bring black people together no matter what unions they were in. I don't know if that makes any sense, but the union movement is still, just like a whole lot of other organizations, fundamentally racist. And so we've got to continue to work for our best interest and fight them to try to end the racism that exists in all these institutions, including the unions.
True indeed.
Was that okay?
Indeed.
I'm just too crazy.
Oh, no, that made a lot of sense here, brother. First, I would like to thank you for coming to our broadcast to show you another understanding. Thank you for the work you're committed and contributing to the past, present, and working committed in the future. Thank you for being steadfast all the years and continue in your pursuit. And I would like for you to give your final thoughts. Leave us with your final thoughts.
My final thought is, if we want freedom and liberation, we've got to love each other. Support each other, and organize with each other and build power. And if we can do that, then we'll make things better, for all of us. Free land.
Body me that, sir. If you have anyone, anyone, loved one, comrade, associate that a lot of my enemy lies, please look into our website, which is www.georgiauniversity.com. Again, it's www.georgiauniversity.com. Long live the resistance, long live your African independent move, and the struggle for land independence. Peace.